Okay, do I have you?
Yes.
Okay, well, hello, everyone. This is Jeff Gaudiosi, and you are on MisplacedStraws.com, where music comes to life. And it's not often that I get to spend a few minutes with someone who more or less created a musical movement. But Chris D has been the frontman of the Flesh Eaters since their inception in 1977, and is truly the godfather of the L.A. punk scene. So it's my honor to welcome Chris D. Welcome, Chris.
Oh, thank you.
Now, the classic lineup of the Flesh Eaters reunited a few years back. Why is now the right time to bring it into the studio and an extended tour?
Well, the you know, we did the first reunion tour in 2006, and we only did three California dates, and the main reason we got together was Mark Arm from Mudhoney had gotten in touch with John. He didn't know how to get in touch with me, and John Doe called me and said, hey, Mark from Mudhoney called, and they want us to get the Minute to Pray Flesh Eaters back together to play a festival with them in England. And I guess Mudhoney, Mudhoney was headlining one of the days for the All Tomorrow's Parties festival that year, and which was in, I believe, May of that year. And they got to pick all the bands that played that day. So they really wanted, you know, any lineup of the Flesh Eaters would have been okay, but they particularly wanted the Minute to Pray, Second to Die lineup, the one that's, you know, been doing the reunion, you know, with Dave Alvin and John Doe.
Yeah, really the classic lineup of the band.
Yeah. It's certainly the most eclectic lineup, and as far as individual members, the most well known. You know, we had so much fun doing that. We'd all been in touch. I wasn't in touch so much with Steve and DJ, but Bill Bibbin had actually played in a lineup at the Flesh Eaters briefly. Another lineup in 97-98 period, and you know, I periodically talked to Dave and John, but we weren't in that close touch. I had a job from 1999 through 2009 working at the American Cinematheque in Hollywood, and for the last 6 years or so of that 10 years I worked there, I was one of the programmers. And then after that I worked from 2009 to 2013 as a college instructor. I was getting flown up from LA to San Francisco once a week to teach 2 days of classes on film history and film genres and stuff. So I was pretty busy doing that, but we had so much fun in 2006. We wanted to try and do it again more regularly. We tried to do it again in 2007, and there were a couple opportunities we could have done it. And then it turns out like one or two of the guys' schedules just couldn't be reconciled. So we just kind of left it like that. And I was busy doing my day job, and they were busy doing all their own stuff. And 2014, I was unemployed for the first time in 15 years. I'd just gone through a very traumatic breakup, and I was kind of at loose ends. And Superior Viaduct, which is a label that's based in San Francisco, was reissuing A Minute to Pray, A Second to Die, and Forever Came Today, the album that came after it,
right,
on vinyl and CD. And Forever King Today had never been reissued since its original 1982 debut. And that was one of the records I get, you know, was getting questions about the most often. So I thought, well, maybe in early 2015, we could, this Minute to Pray lineup, we could get together again and we could even do a couple songs from the Forever King Today album. And we had already, in 2006, done some songs from a couple of the later lineups in 99 and 2004 from the two last albums before this one now. And so I reached out to the guys and was very happy that they were all very into it, and they all figured that we could make a hole in everybody's schedule in January, which is usually kind of a down month for everybody. So we did a 5 shows in January of 2015. And it was, you know, partly to promote the reissue of the records. And once again, we had so much fun, we vowed to do it again soon. And by that time, Dave Alban's manager, Nancy, had started to work with us. And the whole year before the January 2018 gig, starting pretty early in 2017, she'd been working with us pretty regularly as kind of our unofficial manager. And we put together like 8 shows in last year in January 2018. Mm-hmm. And midway through that string of shows, I just thought we were sounding so incredibly good, and, you know, not to be immodest or anything, but I just thought the guys were sounding so tight, and I was singing better than I have in years, and I liked the mix and material. And the cover we had started doing just last year, Green Man Alishi, was really kind of the icing on the cake. I thought, this sounds so incredible, I've got to get it recorded. And I wanted to get the band on record, too, with some of the other stuff that they hadn't played on originally. And so midway through that last January, those dates, I said to the guys, I go, I really want to get this lineup in the studio and record an album, and I'm sure we'll be able to get a deal from somebody. And so everybody was pretty enthusiastic about the idea. A few people had, you know, were kind of devil's advocates about if we can make it work with the schedules. And but everybody wanted to do it so much, we were able to free up time. And I personally had thought it was important to try and do it within a couple months of those dates, so we wouldn't have to go back into the rehearsal studio and rehearse. Yeah,
keep all the momentum.
Yeah, you know, strike while the iron's hot and when we're still tight. And so luckily we freed up, everybody freed up a week, the first week of April, and we got in there, laid down the basics, and everybody was so together, we just flashed through it pretty quickly. And Dave and I had worked on a couple of new songs. I had had a song, both the lyrics and the vocal, since 2002, and I originally wanted to put it on the Miss Muerte Flesh Eaters album, which was at a, you know, the last one before this one. Mm-hmm. And there was an unusual structure to the song, and just it was the song Black Temptation, which opens this new album. Yeah. And we didn't have time to work it up. I didn't have the time and the money for rehearsal back when I did the Miss Muerte record. So I just left that one on, you know, well, this one may never get recorded. because really, in when I did that last record, Miss Muerte, in 2004, I thought, you know, I may never be playing music again, and because I was doing so much other stuff, non-music related.
Right.
Anyway, so David and I worked on that in his living room, and because the other guys weren't around, they were off, you know, doing their own stuff, and Dave was the only one who had some free time right then, and he's, you know, he or John would be the ones I would get together with anyway to work out something like that, so that was good. He was one of the ones who was free, and then the other new song, Ghost Cave Lament, was something I'd been wanting to do, kind of a flamenco-tinged song, but one of, there's a lot of different kinds of flamenco music and songs, and there's a Conte Moro, what they call some, you know, Conte means songs, and Roma dialect, and there's a particular traditional song called Moritas Moras, which roughly means young girlfriend. And I had heard this really, this, almost all the versions sound different from each other. They're very, just a kind of a traditional theme, and different flamenco artists have different versions. And I'm a big fan of this flamenco guitarist who, he died several years ago. It might even be as much as 10 years ago, but he was very popular in Europe and in the United States in the late 50s and all through the 60s, early 70s, Manitas de Plata. And I listened to this 19-minute version of his version, one of his many versions of Moritas Moras, and I just was blown away. And I thought about transposing some of those riffs into a song like the way we played on Minute to Pray, like, for instance, So Long, that song, which is
right,
has a lot of transposed African rhythms and drumming rhythms, and it's very unorthodox in its structure. So that was my idea. And then I played it for Dave, and he fooled around, came up with some riffs. They weren't really that similar to the Moritas Moras stuff. But I liked what he was doing, and so I started singing along to his changes. And we got a verse and a chorus going. And we didn't have that much time to work on it. So we worked on it a few times, and we made impegs of both the songs for the other guys to hear. And that's basically all the other guys knew of those two new songs before we went in the studio. They basically learned those songs in the studio. And the one that in some ways is the most complex is Ghost Kid Lament, the flamenco-ish one. And we got that one on the second take, which is just a miracle. It's truly kind of cosmic that happened. So,
well, one thing, when I first listened to Ghost Kid Lament, to me, it sums up L.A. music. I mean, you can almost hear the lineage of The Doors to you guys, to Concrete Blonde, to Jane's Addiction. It's all in that song. You know, I mean, it really is a really unique piece.
Yeah, and I hadn't really thought about The Doors until I heard the song mixed, and I thought it kind of reminded me. And The Doors were very, Robbie Krieger and those guys, Ray Manzarek, were very influenced by other music, like world music, like Spanish music and African music and Middle Eastern stuff. And you can hear it in especially some of the early albums. And it reminded me of The End from the first album. you know, I'm ashamed to say I'm not very familiar, even though I, Concrete Blonde and Divine Horseman, my other band, we used to rehearse in the same rehearsal studio, and I knew Jeanette Napolitano, you know, and not well, but enough to have a conversation with, and I haven't really listened to their stuff that much. And Jane's Addiction, I was never a huge fan of, so I'm kind of at a loss to know what songs you might be thinking of, but that's fine. I agree with you that there is so much that is in the song that is, it's kind of timeless. From it really refers back to a lot of eclectic influences that were in 60s rock and psychedelia, psychedelic music, a lot of indigenous music from other countries that filtered in to late 60s psychedelic rock. And but it also has that roots flavor to it, both American and Andalusian Spanish, which is southern Spain, and even Middle Eastern, because a lot of the flamenco and the Roma people, some of them have Middle Eastern descent, and a lot of the flamenco music is a kind of a ad hoc mashup of both Spanish and Middle Eastern idioms in music, and especially some of the female vocals, which Julie really picked up on. Julie Christensen, who sang the wordless vocals. I mean, she sang the choruses with me, but I wanted her to do that kind of banshee wail, like a spirit, you know, underneath tons and tons of rock in a mountain, like buried in a cave. And she knew exactly what I wanted, and she had a reference point because she had recently been listening to this, there's a Bulgarian women's choir that does some music that's kind of like that. So there's a lot of Roma, of gypsy influence in that kind of music as well. And she just pulled it off spectacularly, like beyond any of our wildest dreams. And so it's just everybody brought so much to that song. And I wanted to add a soprano sax on that song, on the choruses, because that's the instrument Steve Berlin had played on the original Divine Horseman song off of Minute to Pray. You know, the instrumental breaks in that song were on a soprano sax. And I loved the way it sounded. It sounded kind of otherworldly. And so I had him play that on the choruses. And he was already playing his regular sax as well. You can hear that during the rest of the song. And just the stuff that Dave brought, he came in the next day after we recorded it and added some fills with tremolo guitar. And I was able to keep most of my original vocal. And the first time we ran through it in the studio, it was 20 minutes long, and there were so many good ideas, but it was kind of aimless and formless compared to what we came up with.
And you had to focus a little.
Yeah. And so when I had originally written it with Dave, I knew it was going to be a long song, but I thought it was going to be 7 or 8 minutes. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it was going to be 13 minutes, which is what the second take was. But it was just so perfect, and we didn't want to screw with it. We didn't want to try and cut it down, edit it. I ended up editing it down for the video, which is like around 7 minutes. But on the CD and the vinyl, It's a full 13-minute version. So anyway, I've gone into way too much detail on that. But,
no, not at all. Fascinating. But if we could shift gears a bit and talk
sure.
about sort of the early days of that L.A. punk scene.
Sure.
Did you guys ever feel either a competition or a kinship with the New York and London scenes, or were you guys doing your own?
Well, the person I've known the longest in the lineup is John Doe, and I mm-hmm. met him probably in 1976, and it was right before he and Exene got together, and Exene was working at Beyond Baroque, which is a literary nonprofit foundation. It's very influenced by the whole Beat Generation and that school of literature, and they had a Venice. It was in Venice, California, which is, for people not in the L.A. area, that's Venice, California, the beach that's just south of Santa Monica. And the very bohemian, it's not so much anymore because of all the gentrification. But in the 50s, 60s, 70s, it was very much, first beatnik generation and then hippie and 70s kind of still bohemian, a lot of punk rock stuff. So it was very a good place for Beyond Baroque. And with when I was together with my first wife, Bonnie, she also wrote poetry, and she and I put together a poetry anthology that we put out ourselves. And I knew Beyond Baroque had a typesetting machine that you could use if you were, like an independent nonprofit,
right.
Or had your own project. You could schedule time when they had it free. And so I went to Beyond Baroque and arranged to typeset the book there myself, which I did. And Exene was the one who was working there at the time, and she was the one who showed me how to use a typesetting machine, which is, amazing. And she was also kind of a secretary there, and she handled a lot of stuff there. And I think she worked there for a year or two. And I think that's how John probably met her, because he was going to the Venice Poetry Workshop. I was going to the Venice Poetry Workshop. And we had, kind of a nodding acquaintance. We knew we were kind of like outliers as far as the regular rest of the crowd there. Because the rest of the crowd were more kind of traditional, old hippie, bohemian type people.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the poems were, I don't know, for me, they were pretty boring. And I was looking for more of the William Burroughs, cut up kind of crazy, surreal Dada kind of poetry, or somebody like Jean Genet, or going back to the late 19th century with the symbolists like Rimbaud and Baudelaire and Lautrement and people like that. So it was kind of weird. I never even read any of my poetry there. I'd go. I went at least five or six times, but I never had the guts to read any of my stuff. And I think John maybe read one or two things. But I didn't really connect up with those guys until I started going to The Mask. And I was already a fan of extreme rock music. I mean, to me, it's like the Rolling Stones' first album, England's Newest Hitmakers, is very punk. And some of their, I also love a lot of the other early Stones albums. Like, in fact, almost everything from the first album to Exile on Main Street, I really like a lot. Exile, like with Goat's Head Soup, I was really disappointed in. There were still a few songs on there I liked, but with each album, they lost me more and more. And I, you know, still have a lot of respect for them, but I think all their kind of money and exorbitant leisure time and whatever else distractions, they kind of lost their fire. And Jagger, certainly his peak for lyric writing was in the late 60s. You know, the stuff on Let It Bleed and Beggar's Banquet and some of that is just, you know, incredible. Sticky Fingers. So to me, that was very stuff. And the Doors, you know, I wasn't even thinking in terms of punk back then. I was, you know, when the Stones came out, I wasn't even in high school yet. I was, you know, in sixth or seventh grade. And I remember they played their first American show at Swing Auditorium in San Bernardino, which was literally only about 20 miles from where I lived in Riverside. That was the first American show they did. And I wanted so bad to go, but it was something I couldn't even bring up to my folks. And I was way too young to go on my own. I don't know how old I was. I was probably, I can't even remember. It was 1964, I think. So I would have been, God, I would have been only 11 or 12 years old. So the Swing Auditorium was a place where I went to go see a lot of rock music later. You know, and I saw a lot of bands there later, like Led Zeppelin and Steppenwolf and Traffic and Elton John and, oh, I don't know. It was a big venue for that area. And there, right before I was able to start going to shows on my own, there was a great show there I really wanted to go see. I was a big Janis Joplin fan, but I was a bit even bigger fan of MC5. I just heard their Kick Out the Jams single, which they were actually playing on AM radio in San Bernardino, Riverside when it came out. I couldn't believe this was on the radio even then.
Changed everything, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because it was beyond what I had ever heard. And I also, around the same time, the Stooges' first album came out.
Mm-hmm.
And they were playing that on the local Los Angeles, one of the rock stations, KLOS. And I loved that stuff. And when people trashed both the Stooges and the MC5, it sounded just a bunch of noise or amateurish, you know, because it was so simple. I didn't understand that, you know. To me, it was a logical progression, and
right.
and it was like kind of the ascendancy, where it needed to go. And so I was a huge fan of all that stuff. And I was also a big fan of, like, English blues rock. I was a big Cream fan.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned, like Steppenwolf.
Mm-hmm.
Steppenwolf's first two or three albums I really love a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think John Kay is very underrated. But a lot of their later albums, too, like the Stones, they really, you know, kind of lost it. The whole lineage of British rock to me was very sacred to me. When Fleetwood Mac, way before Buckingham Nicks, when they had Peter Green in the band, and they did like this single, Oh Well, which ended up being on the American LP of Then Play On, and they also had Rattlesnake Shake on that album. And then the last single they did, which was Green Man Alishi, before Peter Green left the band. I just loved that stuff. And it was the epitome of, like, just really tight blues rock. And it was kind of beyond blues rock because it was so much energy in it. And it sounded so grungy, and I loved it. So when Fleetwood Mac, when Peter Green left, and they Kilnhouse, I thought was good at the time, but then they started doing the feature games, and I still listened to them, but I was going, where's the old flu and not? And
the
then
bite was gone.
Yeah, and then when Buckingham Knicks came in, it was just like, oh man, forget it. And you know, the Buckingham Knicks, Fleetwood Mac, the Eagles, trying to think who else, some of those big bands, you know, all those bloated bands like Journey and Foreigner and Yes. And, you know, there's so many punk rock kids now who say they like Yes or they like Journey. And I'm going, oh, my God. They couldn't stand it back then, but these are people my age that were into punk rock. And now they're like all nostalgic for the worst of the prog rock. And I mean, even I was a big Jethro Tull fan, and the first three albums they did, I loved. And I started to kind of lose interest when they did the concept albums, like the first one, Aqualung. There were a couple of good songs, but and then Thick as a Brick just totally lost me. That was the most prog rock I ever got. But anyway, to answer your question, when the British stuff started coming out in 75, 76, I don't know how I was hearing it because it wasn't being played on the radio. And I was still in college, but I was so interested in rock music, and I had gone to see the Stooges when they played a couple years after Raw Power came out. They didn't have a label, and they played the Whiskey a lot. And when I was in college, I was, I don't know, about 20 or 21 years old, and I went to see them three or four nights in a row at the Whiskey. It was with, you know, James Williamson on guitar. It was just un-fucking believable. And I saw the New York Dolls when they came through. I was a huge New York Dolls fan. I was a huge, a huge Bowie fan, especially the man who sold the world through Diamond Dogs. It's still my favorite Bowie, period. I liked some of his other stuff after that, but when he was still doing the glam, there's a lot of that glam rock that he did. It's very punk. Diamond Dogs was a lot of Diamond Dogs was a big influence on me. So when all the stuff like the Pistols and the Damned and the Clash were coming out, and also the Saints from Australia, those four bands, I immediately got those records when they came out on import. I didn't wait for the American versions. And I played those all the time. And that was in 76, early 77. And then I found Slash Magazine, the very first issue. And I wrote to them, and I was just writing poetry at the time. And they liked the poetry, but they said, we don't do poetry. And if you'd like to send us some record reviews or live reviews of bands, we'll look at them. And if we like them, we'll print them. So that's how I started writing for Slash Magazine, because they liked my stuff. And that was it, you know, from there. And the kind of my disconnect from the punk rock scene came when the hardcore scene came in. About 90% of the hardcore bands I really was not a fan of. Partly it was because of I couldn't get into the music. It sounded
lost that sense of melody.
Yeah, and the thing about punk rock from the MC5 and the Stooges up through all the British early punk, like the Damned and the Sex Pistols and the Clash, they all had other influences besides themselves. And it was like when the hardcore scene came out, all they were drawing from was punk. They weren't joined from other musical genres or styles. And there were some of the bands, like when Black Flag came out, I was already friends with Keith Morris, and he gave me their first demo tape before they even had changed their name to Black Flag, when they were still called Panic. And I was blown away. I just thought they were so incredible. And they retained that for quite a while. Hmm. And then I like Keith's Circle Jerks too, although they were a little too jokey for me. But I still related more to like kind of roots-based punk and blues-based punk, which that's why I got on so well with Jeffrey Lee Pierce, because he really had that background in blues, but he was really into punk rock and reggae. So the Gun Club was huge. Hmm. I loved those guys. I loved X. That was how I became friends with John. I started going to the Mask, and I saw them play, and I go, oh, my God, that's Johnny Mancini from Beyond Baroque. And I went and started talking to him, and we became friends. And I used to go over to the garage where they were rehearsing. This was before they even had DJ as a drummer. And then a couple of years after that, I met Dave Alvin through John and Exene. We all went down to a party at the Blasters house in Downey, and I met Dave. And Dave was really excited to meet me. He loved my writing and said that he really liked No Questions Asked, which was the first Fleshies album.
Yeah.
Which even already I wasn't that fond of, because the production is so lousy. And I was really starting to hate my singing. And so for him to say that he liked my stuff, I was really like, wow, this guy's really cool. He's doing all this roots music, but he's got a really open mind. He loves all different kinds of music. And he's a fucking great guitar player. So I became very good friends with him too. And that was how John and Dave got involved with the Minute to Pray lineup. Mm-hmm. I went to them when I had the idea for that second Flesh Eaters album. I told them, I knew you guys have got your stuff, your own stuff. So this is going to be temporary. You know, if we can, we'll do some shows to back up the album, but I know it's not a permanent thing. And we got Bill Bateman from the Blasters to play drums, and DJ from X to play marimbas. And Steve Berlin was playing with a lot of different people at the time. He hadn't joined Los Lobos yet. And he was playing a lot with Top Jimmy and Fast Freddy and the Precisions and got a couple other bands. And then he started playing with the Blasters about a year later too, he and Lee Allen. So they had two horn players. And and then a couple of years after that, he joined Los Lobos. But that's by a long way around kind of answering your question about about all that stuff. Yeah. How it originated, and, you know. So,
and now you guys got about a month left on the tour. You know, you're ending up here in my neck of the woods in the Northeast with shows in Boston and New York and Philly.
Yeah.
How has the reaction been playing these places where this lineup never made it to before? And also, you know, what's next for the band? Is this lineup going to continue going forward, or what's next?
Well, the last 6 months or so, mm-hmm. Nancy, who's Dave's manager, has been our official manager, and she's been just super, making so much stuff happen and mm-hmm. helping to keep the momentum going. And she and Dave were really the people that got the Yep Rock deal. And we got that deal before we were even done with our basic tracks of the album in April. And Yep Rock hadn't even heard the record. They didn't hear it for another couple months, because we didn't want them to hear it until we were had done with all the mixes. And when they finally heard it, they just were blown away. It was better than they had expected. And so they really wanted to put as much resources as possible behind it. They realized we couldn't tour all year long because of the other guys' commitments. You know, the guys weren't going to, you know, stop doing their own stuff, no matter how popular this gets. So,
right.
But I think it's kind of startled us that it's kind of taken on a life of its own to the extent it has. And we've gotten, we get a lot of great response at the show. I mean, people go wild when we played so far. And we just, you know, done the West Coast a couple of times, and we played Phoenix and Tucson for the first time this time. And now we're, you know, doing this area of the South, which is just going to be New Orleans and Houston, Austin, Dallas. That's all we've got time for, because the guys have got other stuff going. And then we've got a couple weeks off while they do their stuff. And then we go to Chicago and start going up through the Midwest and down to Philly and up, you know, D.C. and Boston and New York. So, but I'm anticipating, you know, there's really good pre-advance ticket sales in most places. Minneapolis, I think, is almost sold out, and I think they're doing quite well in New York already. In Boston, it's almost sold out. So Boston,
yeah,
is always, Massachusetts, I've always had a disproportionate amount of fans of my music, both Flesh Eaters and Divine Horsemen, from Massachusetts. And it's funny because I really probably have more fans in Massachusetts than I do in even Southern California. So
really? That's interesting.
Well, that was the way it was in the 80s. We'll see if it holds true now.
Well, I'm right in mine, Connecticut. So
yeah, and there's also the European countries. I had a European label during the 80s. I was Divine Horsemen was all the records were on New Roads Records, and a couple of the early SST Flesh Eaters albums from early 90s were on New Rose. And New Rose put out a couple of greatest hits that SST also put out that had some of the stuff in Minute to Pray and Forever Came Today.
Mm-hmm.
Forever Came Today had gotten released in Italy, and so had Minute to Pray. Minute to Pray had come out in England. You know, and these were separate labels. These weren't like major labels. These were separate, you know, labels based in their respective countries. But I have a really disproportionate amount of fans from Italy also. I have an unbelievable amount of Italian Facebook friends. And it's like most of them are because of the music. So it strikes a chord somehow in some folks, you know, some communities. So it's some more than others. So that's interesting to me, but I don't know what exactly it is. But anyway.
Well, thank you for your time. I really appreciate the chance to get to talk to you. I encourage everyone to check out the record, The Flesh Eaters, I Used to Be Pretty. It's out now on Yep Rock Records. Go to flesheaters.com and you can see the rest of the tour dates. Look forward to having you guys up here in the Northeast in a month or so. And,
yeah,
I
should mention, to answer your question, we are intending to take this further. I mean, the rest of the year is going to be tough because the other guys have got stuff going on.
Right.
But we may be able to fit in a couple more shows, but, you know, in the fall, I've told the guys I'm already organizing material for a next album. Just yet, Brock has an option for another album, and I think with if the record continues to do as well as it's been doing the last couple months, I'm pretty sure they're going to want to do another one. And just a matter of when we get to do it. It could be, I think the soonest would be a year, but it might be a couple of years from now. But assuming all our health holds up and, you know, everything, you know, the world doesn't fall into chaos.
you never know.
Yeah. And I'm also going to be doing some recording with Divine Horseman.
Julie, that's great.
Julie Christensen and I and our guitar player, Peter Andrus, are going to do an album as Divine Horseman sometime later in the year. And we're starting to pull together material for that. So,
well, I'd love to talk to you again when that comes out and, you know, do a little bit of the history of Divine Horseman as well.
Okay. All right, man. Thanks so much for having me
on.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, have a great show. I know you're in New Orleans tonight, so have a great time there, and good luck on the rest of the tour.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Chris. Bye.
Yep. Bye.